To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hey guys, welcome to Two Dimension Comics Podcast. I'm your host, Dallas Bushev. We're trying something a little new this episode, so bear with us. What I'm doing, I'm going to be broadcasting this simultaneously. This will be on our most recent episode of the podcast, and it'll also be a short video on our YouTube page. You can find our podcast pretty much anywhere that you can find podcasts in general. You can find us on iTunes. We also have a website, bunchofdorks.com. Go on that site, you click on the Cyclops, takes you to an entire list of all our shows. You can find us on YouTube now. It's pretty new. We have a couple videos up. There's another video on the YouTube page that has the whole gang together hanging out for Free Comic Book Day. Some really good video of just everybody just kind of chilling, hanging out. We're at Yancey Street Comics, so you get some video of that and a little bit of the costume contest, too. So it's pretty cool. So check that out. Just go on YouTube. Just keyword Two Dimension Comics. You'll be able to find us. Thanks a lot. So, real quick, I picked up some new books. I started picking up a new monthly. It's called Injection by Warren Ellis, drawn by Declan Shalvey, and the colors are by Jordi Belair. Got the first 5 issues so far. So, real quick, I just want to talk about it a little bit. The writing, as expected, is very Warren Ellis. It's methodical. It's slow. There's huge payoff if you stick with the story. If you pay attention, you follow it. The art's pretty stylistic. It fits the theme well enough. There's a lot of fantastic flashbacks, and the art, the background art, is very well executed there. I really like it. So, of course, we have Jordi Belair. She does the colors now. As usual, she's awesome. She's everywhere in the medium right now. And for this particular book, the colors are what really pull you in, even more so than the art for me. It's an obvious combination, but the colors create such an amazing mood. You just feel like you're being rained on during an overcast day in England. It's got that kind of downtrodden feeling to it, which is exactly what Ellis is going for, I believe. So, here's an overview, a quick overview of the book, and minor spoilers in here, but I'm going to keep this as vague as possible. Basically, the story centers around a group of 5 exceedingly intelligent individuals. They've inadvertently created a program that's out of their hands, and it's menacing the world as we know it. So they're kind of going about trying to fix this, fix the problem that they created. The story itself unfolds very slowly. The scenes kind of spin around. They go from different places in the world, and they focus on the different members of the group who are not all together at the same time, at least not at the start of the book. If you're ready for a bit of a mind bender like this, if it sounds like something up your alley, if you like Warren Ellis, it's got surreal visuals. It's got his trademark in-your-face dialogue and themes. It's absolutely fantastic. I really do like it. I recommend it for you guys. All right. Thank you so much. There should be a lot more videos up on YouTube soon, and the new episode of the podcast should be coming out in about a week. So thanks a lot, guys. Enjoy yourselves.
All right. Thank you, Dallas. I'm Don, and you are?
Al.
And we're here to talk about comic books.
And we're here to talk about, what was it, Hilda?
Yeah, Hilda. This is a book I just picked up. I picked up on Free Comic Day. I've never heard of it. I've never heard of the cartoonist. I like the colors. I like the art style. And I have no idea who publishes this thing. I don't even know if it's going to be a regular comic or if it's some type of trade paperback. Al pointed out it's No Brow is the publisher, which I've never heard of.
Me neither.
But Hilda, it looks like just a regular girl, but I guess it's a fantasy-based comic. She's in some type of little village. She's got some kind of squirrel fox with antlers sidekick. And the whole thing starts out with her running, chasing down a divot of land with legs with a little house on it. She ends up running through four boulders, and they say they're, she says, trolls. She ends up catching a divot of land. She's on a farm, And the farmer just mentions to her, I can't believe you're on the other side of the wall. And then she realizes, you know, that's why the trolls are there. I guess the town they're in is protected. While she's talking, she realizes she's late for dinner. And so she heads back, says, my mom's going to freak if I'm on the other side of the wall. The little house is full of these little tiny people. Eventually, she goes back to the little village they're from, sticks it in there, and tells them if a divot of land ever pops up, get off of it. And then a couple other things go on, and then it says to be continued. I like the art style, I like the colors, and it's got my attention, and this is also something for kids as well. So thank you, Free Comic Day. I'm going to have to look up something else to buy.
Did you get that at, whatchamacallit?
Yancey?
Yancey?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the books I picked out.
Oh, I didn't see you picking that one up. Oh, okay.
But I think I picked this up when we first went over there, and I got two books, and later Jim Johnson said we could get four.
Did you read the whole thing?
No, I just read it first. You looked through it. As you mentioned one of the characters.
Yeah, Spectre Man's in this Akisi book, but I thought maybe you read the whole thing. I have no idea what it is. I mean, it looks like an underground. I mean, the middle story does. I don't know.
Yeah, this is a completely different cartoonist. You know, it reminds me of Chester Brown.
Yummy Fur, yeah.
Have you said Spectre Man. Have you ever read him?
Spectre Man was Ultraman.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's why I was freaked out by it. Spectre Man was an Ultraman kind of like TV show. My friend has some copies of it. Yeah, that guy there, right there.
Oh, because the kids are watching television.
Yeah, but...
Oh. No,
it's an interesting reference, and they're like black kids or Haitian kids or something. I don't know what the deal is, but...
Yeah, it looks like it might be... Because it doesn't look like regular American houses. Yeah, no, I just read this one and liked it. I haven't read... And there's a third story. It looks real Japanese manga. Yeah, no, I have no idea. But each one says to be continued. I like how it's different styles.
Yeah.
So someday when I find out what these are, no brow. I'll find out more later.
Yeah, I don't know.
But anyway.
It's cool. What's that? Well, you might as well go through your stuff.
Right.
Jonah Hex.
One time Al and I went to Wilson's Book World.
Oh, the Darwin Cook one.
Well, yeah, but that's not the one. Al pulled out issue 50 of Jonah Hex, and he pointed out, asked if I'd ever seen it, and I'd been looking for it. Every store I went to, they said they had it, but they sold out. It was out of print. But Jimmy Palmiotti and another guy wrote Jonah Hex. But Darwin Cook drew the 50th issue, and everybody was talking about it. And when Al saw I was starting to cry, he handed it to me, let me buy it. Thank you very much. But it was good. And then I found that he did an earlier story. I had it on a wish list on a comic seller's, but I never picked it up. And yesterday in Wilson's, I was just going through, and there it was. The artwork is fantastic. The story was good. The only thing it started out, it's real wordy. You're getting it from the viewpoint of a young boy. He's talking about his father and how they're out in the Canadian wilderness. You know, it's freezing. And his father's dead, and the boy's on his own, and he's about to be attacked by wolves. And then Jonah Hex shows up and starts killing the wolves. He's rough on the boy. And then the Canadian Mounties come in and say Jonah Hex shouldn't be here, and they knew he was a bounty hunter. So they chip the ice out under him, and he falls in and leave him for dead. And then Jonah Hex gets out, freezing, and then the dog sled dogs come over and help him. After that, the story started. I had trouble starting this off because it just got so wordy, and I'm thinking, why does this have to be so wordy? And then finally, he gets on, and he starts explaining about sled dogs and how basically you have to raise them from birth, and he knew this guy didn't do it. But later on, he starts showing that Jonah Hex, even though there's all these stories about him, he's kind of a jerk as well, and he left the kid to die on his own. But then the story finishes, and basically the kid explains that, you know, you can always tell these stories about somebody. And some of it's true, but you got to remember they're still human beings. But then the boy explained he learned from it. Okay, it was nice.
That's pretty neat. This is a one-shot, I guess, right?
Well, I think it's probably continuing for Jonah Hex, but it's just a one-shot for Darwin Cook. I know he did issue 33, and he did issue 50. And I think, didn't you get a later issue where they're talking about him and Jonah Hex and some other guy that It was supposed to be Jonah Hex. You talked about the show once.
Don't remember.
Okay.
I just remember giving you that one because I saw Doe and Cook on it, but I don't remember the other one. They may be.
Yeah. Well, I was starting to whine when you gave it to me.
I don't remember. But is that Catgirl by Darwin Cook also?
No, Catwoman.
Catwoman.
Darwin Cook and who's that right? Ed Brubaker did Catwoman for about a year. I've got that in the trade, and it's really good.
Oh, Polito.
Yeah, I found these three, again, in the dollar boxes at Wilson's. It's Javier Polito, but he draws differently than the one that you turned me on to.
He's drawn like Darwin Cook.
You know, it reminds me of Darwin Cook. It reminds me of Shane Glines.
Uh-huh.
It reminds me a little bit of, I can't think of that guy now. Who's the one that wrote Kyle Baker?
Yeah.
And some of it sort of reminds me a little bit of Batman Year One, a guy, David Mazzucchelli.
Yeah.
Slightly. But they're nice. These are old issues, but I guess he did three because I looked at this 17, 18, and 19. 16 and 20 were by different artists. But these stories were good. They have a character called Slam Bradley, which I guess is from Detective Comics in the Golden Age. But he's a detective, and the way they draw him, he looks like put to sea Gregory Peck. But he's got a relationship with Catwoman in these. The Darwin Cook issues, I remember that they were there, but I didn't remember them as an item. But she's dealing with the fact that her sister is dead. And some of it's from her side and some of it's from his side. But really, really neat stories.
I remember seeing these years ago.
I never noticed them. I looked through the ads, and I remember during that time while I was reading, but I never touched these. Now I kind of regret it. They're kind of nice. Ed Brubaker, I guess, wrote Catwoman for quite a while, but, you know, different artists would come in and draw them.
Cool.
But anyway.
Yeah, nice. Did you read all three of them?
No, I just read the first one. And
I wonder if there's more by the team.
These are the only three they had in there. 16 was by a different artist, and 20 was by a different artist.
Oh.
But I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if he came in and did some other issues at another time. But
let me see what year that is, though.
Javier Polito, for some reason, I want to say he did another one.
He did. He did a few books, yeah.
Again, until you tell me about She-Hulk, I've never read him, but that's not the Jaime Hernandez style so much.
No.
But at the same time, you still see the roots of
yes.
Javier Polito. He's still got a footprint.
Yeah, I can't find an indicia in here telling me what year it is.
Yeah, that's so bizarre.
But they're 250 books, so it was a while ago. Cover price is 250, so.
That's so weird when you're talking about 250 sounds like a lot, but that's a while ago. Yeah, where is the indicia? Oh, it's in the back.
Oh, it is in the back?
The
okay.
Very, very last page. 2003. Why is it 2003 doesn't seem long ago to me?
2003?
Yeah.
That guy's been around that long? That's like 13 years ago.
Yeah, but it still seemed like the other day to me.
No, I mean, I was living in another town and life was a lot different, but wow. I didn't know that guy was been around that long. Wow.
Yeah, me neither.
That might have been some of his earliest work.
It's nice, though. If it is earliest work, it's. I mean, like I said, I'm happy to get these.
Cool.
And I'll look for more.
All right, so what's next?
Well, I'm all talked out.
No, you brought some books, though.
Well, this is for
Palooza.
Yeah, we both have files for Pula Palooza. I guess let's take a music break, and
all
then
right.
We'll be back.
Okay.
herself the bitter drink. Bowman smiles at me, his wife, she gives the secret wink. He listens patiently to me, my story I unfold. I see their faces change, the lights grow dim, I'm losing hope.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
All right, that was Bebop Deluxe with Life in the Air Age. That was the first concert I ever went to, Bebop Deluxe, back in 1977 at Gusman Hall in downtown Miami.
Whatever happened to those guys?
Bill Nelson is still around. There's a video of him, Bill Nelson and the Gentlemen Rocketeers, and they still do all that great stuff. The bass player passed away, and the other two guys, I don't know. But Bill Nelson still sounds great, still sounds the same. I mean, like I said, YouTube, check him out.
You know, they were a band I never listened to. I remember Circus Magazine in the late 70s. That's when a lot of newer bands were starting to come in. Tommy Two Tone, what was that other guy? Greg Kinn, you know, to me they were all new guys.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of them. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones, but they had advertisements in for Bebop Deluxe. I never listened to them, but then when I was in college, one of the guys in my fraternity had a record. He used to play a lot of the Tubes, you know, he liked them, and he had Bebop Deluxe, and there were some other bands like that. And I just remember listening to it with him. But every band, it was just, to me, kind of under the radar, and they disappeared to me. But evidently
they did
not
disappear. Well, he broke up the band in 79, and he started solo. Hmm. Bill Nelson's Electric Noise and solo stuff. And, you know, he was doing his stuff, and then he just kind of faded away, and never really faded away, but kind of like came back. But I don't know why he broke up that band. I don't get it. I know maybe he wanted to just do something different. I don't know, but his solo works good, except a lot of it's instrumental and experimental. So I used to buy cassettes of it, and some of them were like songs, and some of them were like long suites of music. All good, but, you know, self-indulgent maybe. I don't know. But he's still around. Still sounds good.
I haven't heard that name.
Yeah, Bill Nelson and the Gentleman Rocketeers. It's on YouTube. It's him and a bunch of other guys, and they sound just like Bebop Deluxe, and still plays great. So, but that's from 77. Life in the Air Age, I think, or Live in the Air Age was the name of the album. And it's got Metropolis on the cover. It's got the robot lady on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
I have it on white vinyl back then.
Was that their first album?
No.
How long, when did they start?
73.
Oh, I didn't realize. I just knew it because it was in like 78 or 79 is the first time I ever saw them. You know, in an advertisement.
Yeah, that's when they started like to hit big.
Oh, okay.
But I started in 73, and remember in the 70s, 76, 77, 78, even 75, live albums started to be a big deal.
Yeah.
Kiss Alive, Frampton Comes Alive, So and So Alive. Well, then they did their double live album. That kind of like gave them a boost. But unfortunately, 2 years later, they just went, "See ya." Anyway, that's that story. So let me pull some of your comics then.
All right. See what you got there. So Pulapalooza.
All right.
So Al's grabbing from my pile.
All right. This one feels old. It sure is old.
We got them upside down. You can tell by the advertisement.
Well, the advertisement is cool for the Invaders. And, oh, my God. This is a great book. Aquaman by Nick Carty.
Yeah, and signed by him.
Did you? Oh, yeah.
Melody got it signed for me.
No, it's from 60-something. 68, yeah.
That's, yeah. I love Nick Carty. Aquaman, even though people make fun of him now, was always one of my very favorite characters. I love the Ramona Freyden stories. And I love the Nick Carty stories. This one's, it's a alien woman. She's got white skin and purple hair. And the cover, it says, "Die, my love, die." And she's shooting him with a gun. But basically, it's an alien invasion. They're water-breathing people like all the people in Atlantis. And she's pairs up with Aquaman, and Mira, you know, she's being kind of mean to her. And I don't know. It was just always the one also, this is when the Aquaman cartoon was out in the 60s.
Because, is that your original book from 1968?
I didn't have it then. A kid that lived down the street from me, I always read comics, he read mine, and he showed me his pile. And he had Action Comics. I think it had a Neil Adams cover. It was had the Superman Revenge Squad and the Batman Revenge Squad. No, it wasn't Action. It was World's Finest. It was Superman and Batman, but it had the Revenge Squads for both. And he traded me this issue of Action Comics and that World's Finest for some of my books. But I guess he got them from a garage sale. He also had an Avengers John Buscema drew. And that was the first time I'd ever read an Avengers book. And what was strange was Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor wasn't in it. There was Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver, Goliath, Black Panther, and the Vision.
Mm. What number was it, you remember?
It's the one where I guess they were broke and they were working for hire. And there was some rich guy saying, you know, they were doing demolition work for some building. He says, "I've learned everything has a price, even these guys." And it said the Avengers for hire. But,
those are great books.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful book. Yeah. I like the Jim Aparo ones, too.
Yeah, I do, too. And, you know, Jim Aparo, it seemed like Aquaman was really underwater, the way Jim Aparo drew it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Aquaman always had good artists, and the stories I thought were good. He was one of those characters, I hate to make fun of it, I always wondered in the Justice League, I love those stories, but later on, it seemed like he was the worst fifth wheel, because they go to places and they had no water, and I thought, why is he with them? And I kept thinking, if most of the Earth is covered in water, and he's the only underwater superhero, why is he hanging out on land, you know? And I remember in the 80s, DC didn't really seem to know what to do with him. And then I guess it was Neil Ponzer did a miniseries, and they gave him a blue camouflage-looking suit, which looked kind of neat. And then later in the 90s, I think it was, when they turned him into more of a Conan the Barbarian with a beard and he had a harpoon hand. And they said that the family man that we all knew in the 60s just wasn't working anymore. But I love those. Meryl was a mermaid from another dimension, had hard water powers. That was awesome.
Do you remember when Aquaman started? He wasn't a Golden Age character, was he?
I think he came in the 50s.
Silver Age guy, right? Silver Age only?
I don't know. Well, no, I guess you're right. I still consider the 50s part of the Golden Age.
Well, there was that time in the 50s when they stopped doing superhero. They weren't doing any superhero books, and the horror comics ended, and there was all these other... Didn't the superheroes all come back when DC with the Flash?
Yeah, you're right.
Is that when Aquaman started around then?
I don't know. I'm going to guess.
I know Submariner was like the Golden Age underwater guy.
That is something. I always looked at Submariner as a ripoff of Aquaman. I mean, that's how I always saw it. And I was completely wrong. The Submariner was a Golden Age character, and I found out that Aquaman was copied from Submariner.
Yeah, I wasn't sure because I never really...
Knew that. I read it, and they were talking about how DC didn't have an underwater character, so they created Aquaman, and it was based off Namor. I never knew that. I always thought it was the opposite. The only thing is Namor stayed, you know, he stayed the same, basically, and he interacts with the other characters in Marvel. Aquaman is the opposite. He just kind of turned into a fifth wheel lame duck kind of character. And I don't know.
Okay, it's a great book though. The guy I used to work with, man, he wouldn't sell it either. He had a bound set of Aquaman, I think they were the Jim Aparo ones. I'm not sure if Roy Thomas was writing or somebody like that. But he bought it off of a guy who had bought it off of Roy Thomas. He had the bound ones, and that guy sold it to him. He had it in the store, and I was looking through, and I'm like, "Oh, this is beautiful." But he wouldn't sell it.
Yeah, those stories. His kid died. Those Jim Aparo stories.
Oh yeah.
They killed Aquaman's son, who was always a baby, kind of like Franklin Richards, and He died, and at one point there was some other underwater group that was a religion that was pacifist. And then, I don't know if it was the Black Manta. I think Black Manta was what killed him.
Yeah, I remember the Black Manta.
And then, at one point after, I'm barely remembering this. I was in high school, but he had a choice between, Aqualad could kill Aqualad or save his son. And of course, Aqualad said, "I'm sorry, but I got to save my son." And of course, the son died anyway. And then it was all over. I guess Mira wouldn't talk to Aquaman because their son was dead.
I don't remember that.
And then Aqualad was kind of shattered because, you know, Aquaman raised him. It was always the two of them before Mira. And he said, "I can't believe you're going to do that." You know, and then he left. And I don't remember too many Aquaman stories after it, but I guess that's when they were starting to show the.
Didn't Aquaman used to show up in? I remember him showing up in a double feature DC book. It was Aquaman. This is later in the 80s, and some other character was it? Did they revamp Adventure and bring like Aquaman and Starman? Or
they might have.
That was Plastic Man and Starman.
You talked about it in one past episode, but I'm not sure if that's I'm not sure. Were they rotating characters all the time?
No, it was two ten-page stories. I think it was Adventure.
But it was always Plastic Man and Starman, or was it different characters each time?
Yeah, I think it was always, but...
Oh, yeah, I
don't remember, but I seem to remember Aquaman coming back years later, before he got the hook hand and all that stuff.
Bruce Timm was talking about, in a Superman cartoon they did, Aquaman showed up, but it was funny because they made him more like Namor, like he had a war with the surface world. But he was in the orange and green suit, which made me happy. And on Bruce Timm was saying he never liked the hook hand, harpoon hand Aquaman.
No.
But later he was talking about, I guess when they brought back the Justice League, he said that the Aquaman that, you know, they knew from the 50s, even though he tried hard to make it work, and of course they turned him into Namor, he said it just didn't really seem to work. And when they had the Justice League cartoon, Aquaman came back as the Conan the Barbarian harpoon hand guy. And Bruce Timm said, I hated that character. I didn't like it. And he says, but, you know, that was what was in the comics, and we realized the old one wasn't working. He said he grew to love it. He says, he basically looked at Aquaman more as Conan. You know, like the sea was a wild, vast, you know, untamed area. And it would make sense if he'd be more of a barbarian type, you know, king. And I liked it at first because he didn't have the harpoon hand. He had two. But then I think it was the Ocean Master cut it off. Oh, and I'm thinking, well, I could think of a lot of things I'd rather have than a harpoon on my hand. What if you have to scratch your nose?
Really?
You know?
Yeah, you got to learn how to do it with your other hand.
Anyway. But he turned out to be a pretty neat character on that.
Now he's like, I don't know. They showed a picture of a Garth Clam in a movie. He's like dark hair and a beard. And
looks kind of cool. I don't care for the movies, but I've seen the image you're talking about. On that Brave and Bold cartoon, it was kind of fun. It had that Silver Age Batman. My daughter was watching it. She kept telling me all excited, and I watched it with her. When Aquaman was on, they had him portrayed as a Greek. He was bigger than life. He was, you know, all wild and out there and boisterous. But it was the harpoon hand Aquaman. I don't know if he had a harpoon hand, but it was the Conan the Barbarian looking. And as a Greek, he was wonderful, you know, and all over the top. And Holly kept laughing and giggling. That was her favorite. She said, you know, in this cartoon, it's like Batman is the straight man just looking at all these oddities running around all over the place. Yeah, that's kind of how they're playing it.
Cool.
Anyway, so now I get to go from one of Al's fantastic.
These are all magazines. I'm just doing Magapalooza.
All right, I got one.
What is that?
All right, this is one I've never heard of. Psycho?
Oh, Skywald, yeah.
A Skywald horror mood public. Now, you've talked about Skywald. I've never bought
There's
one.
There's actually a book on Skywald that just came out. Yeah, this was another imitator of Warren. Here's Pablo Marcos. They started doing characters like the Heap and stuff like that. This is, if I remember their history correctly, this is like Waldman and, oh God, who was it? I can't remember. But these are the guys that did these reprints. They were called IW reprints in the 60s and 50s of old Golden Age books that were deemed to be in public domain. And then, like in the 70s, when everybody was doing black and white comics, they started their own line. There was Psycho, there was Nightmare, then they did a bike one called Hellrider, and then they did a crime one. They lasted for a little while. You know, they were on the stands. I never bought these because I was always buying the Warrens, but I don't know if this is one of the ones that I got in. In 1990, whatever, 4 or 5, this guy back in South Florida told me there's a bookstore that's got a stack of these. And they're like a buck. So one day, he goes, one day we'll go. So one day he goes, hey, you want to go? It was like in West Palm or something. So we went up, and sure enough, they had a big old stack. I don't know if this is one of them, because they would put a sticker on them. So the guy put it in. I bought a bunch of them. This might have come in the pile or whatever, but they're not bad. They're basically like the early issues would have like Jeff Jones would do a story, Ross Andrew, Kaluta, Rich Buckler. But then as it went on, it was a Spanish artist that they would get. I would imagine these Spanish artists were very cheap, and they came from a Spanish studio in Spain, I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Marcos was like here, I think, so he did a lot of work for them. But they're fun, you know. They're pretty rough. I mean, they're a little, you know, some of these stories are very, like, nihilistic, but, yeah, there's a, people, you know, enjoy these or whatever. There was a book written about them, you know. I mean, like I said, who else worked in these? I can't think right now, but yeah, Psycho.
You know, I've never heard of Skywald. I learned it from you when you talk about them. And sometimes I want to say I've seen these on the stands.
Back then?
Yeah, but there was a bunch of different kind of horror mags. I remember the Warren stuff. And I remember there were some other ones.
Yeah, there's some other ones in there, too. The Eerie Publications and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
and I learned that stuff from you. Although I've seen a plethora, I never bought those. This one, I like them. They look good. They had a feel. But even though it was done in the 70s, it has a, It seemed like an older time, you know. It seemed like it came from another time.
It looked like it came from the 50s. I don't know if those are recycled stories or not. I know the Erie publications did, but yeah, I mean, if you went to the stands and they didn't have Creepy or Erie, then you saw Psycho, I go, oh, that looks cool, you know. But I know I never bought these off the stands. I'm not even sure if they were distributed. Well, they had to have been, because I got some bunch of them on West Palm. I don't remember seeing them on the stands that much.
They might have just been in certain places.
In certain drugstores or in certain, certain distributors. I don't remember how the distribution system worked, but I know certain stores carried certain books. You know, like 7-Elevens didn't carry any of this stuff. You had to go to Liggett Drugs or some off kind of convenience stores, like, you know, Little General. I don't know if Little General carried them or not, but anyway, yeah. That's a Skywald magazine, so
that's
there
nice.
You go.
Right, so now it's back to the comic pile.
Well, let's do this one. This looks like it's from the 80s. Oh, this is a great book. Weird World, number 2, from DC with Tarzan and John Carter.
Yeah, Tarzan Presents. So this is my introduction
Beautiful, by Murphy Anderson.
There was two things on this. I bought that because I liked the cover. Joe Kubert did it, and it was, it looks like it's supposed to be David Ines from the Pellucidar series at the World Earth's Core. But he's on some type of anti-gravity jet sled going against a dinosaur.
That's a great book.
And inside, it starts out with John Carter of Mars, and it's drawn by Murphy Anderson quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second story is the Pellucidar series at the Earth's Core with David Ines. I think Alan Weiss drew that one.
Yeah, Alan Weiss inked by the Krusty Bunkers, which is Neil Adams. And here's an interesting, Krusty Bunkers. Here's an interesting insight. This character here.
Perry, Abner Perry,
Yeah, you know who he's based on?
No.
Roy Crankle.
Are you serious?
No. Yeah, I am serious, yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah, he's based on Roy Crankle. You know, especially in some of these panels like this one. That's what Crankle looked like. I mean, I don't know. It's almost like an inside thing, you know. I've never actually researched it or anything like that, but I've seen pictures of Crankle. And to me, it's like somebody said, hey, you know, let's stick Roy Crankle in this
book. Well, it makes sense. You know, it's funny, when I read those, he
again,
was,
if I'm wrong, we'll look it up, but I'm pretty sure.
He's so different than all the other characters in the book, and but he was one that, as a kid, I was 10 when I bought this. But he was a character I always remembered. You know, he was kind of a standout, but I didn't ever realize that was Roy Crinkle. Of course, these guys all like Crinkle.
I'm assuming this. Like I said, I've never researched it. Yeah. But like I said, I've seen pictures of Crinkle, and he had that hair, and he had that expression on his face. I mean, I think he wore glasses, but I'm not sure. But man, that character looks a lot like Roy Crinkle.
I believe you.
I could be just, you know, I could be proven wrong, but that's my opinion anyway. But those are... I remember buying those. I remember buying the Tarzans by Kubert and... the Korax.
Yeah. Well, this is when DC started doing the Tarzan work and Joe Kubert.
They just
Kubert
got to get the RB books, yeah.
Yeah. But it was just like a whole world opened up for me, because when this came out, it said Tarzan Presents. And that's when I found out Edgar Rice Burroughs. All the paperbacks were appearing, like Eternal Warrior and stuff like that. And it says from the creator of Tarzan, Edgar Rice Burroughs. And I was kind of fascinated, because Tarzan was a character that, to me, was an always character. Everybody, you know, I saw the Johnny Weissmuller's movies, and my parents used to watch.
Oh, yeah.
My question is, on the title, with Tarzan's head, who drew that? Do you know?
Russ Manning.
That's what I always thought, because it was Russ strange, because I was used to the Joe Kubert Tarzan.
He did a few.
Oh, yeah, I liked Russ Manning's Tarzan. I seen those in Gold Key.
Yeah, it's when he did them, yeah.
You know, Steve Rude, he has that Andrew Loomis look, but he also has a Russ Manning look to his work,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he sure does, especially when he was doing Nexus.
Yeah, yeah.
It was almost like, you're right, Andrew Loomis inked by Russ Manning, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, he's his own person. He's got a lot of different, you know, sometimes Steve Rude reminds me of Dr. Seuss, some of the aliens and stuff he drew. He can make a Jack Kirby feel, Alex Toth. I mean, there's he's got a lot of influences.
Yeah, he wears them well. He's a good mimic, and he's got his own, brings his own style to it.
But All right.
That's a great book. I mean, you like Alan Weiss?
I do and I don't. I bought them.
Oh, you think you're picking a Vampirella there?
Oh, wow.
Is it a Vampirella?
Yeah, it is. You know, when I saw the back, I thought it was a spirit.
Well, there is one of those in here somewhere.
So I've got Vampirella 55. And again, as we talked about last episode, to me, Vampirella was an odd character because I remember from the Aurora model kits that, you know, Al and I both remember that I didn't realize put Aurora in trouble.
Yeah.
And, but then I'd see the books and I never read them because I would have got murdered if I would have brought them home. But, I remember one of my best friends, we had a bunch of comics, and his older sister, who no longer lived with him, she came in and was looking through the comics, mostly Conan, and she said, "Do you have any Vampirella?" And I was surprised. I didn't realize it was really a comic.
Is that the one? That's not the Wallywood story, no.
That's Art story, Gonzalez. Archie Goodwin, Art Jose Gonzalez. Can you tell me what Vampirella was?
She was an alien from the planet Draculon.
Really?
Yeah, she was an alien.
Was she on Earth?
No, she was, they brought her to Earth. I can't remember how, but she came to Earth. I don't remember the exact story, but she was an alien. It was the whole concept of it was created by Ackerman, Forth Ackerman. And the first story was drawn by Tom Sutton, believe it or not. Yeah, Forth Ackerman created Vampirella.
I didn't know that.
And the suit was designed by Trina Robbins, but Frank Frazetta obviously did the definitive version of it. Yeah, Trina Robbins designed
it. Okay, now this is all new to me. All this is new. So Forrest Ackerman basically created her.
Yeah.
Trina Robbins designed the suit. And was Frazetta the... Well, you said Tom Sutton drew the first
Tom
story.
Tom Sutton drew the first story. Frazetta drew the first painting. You know, the definitive look. I'm pretty sure... I know Ackerman... Let's put it this way. Ackerman wrote the first story, and I'm assuming he created...
The concept,
but then it was taken to, onto different things. But she was an alien from the planet Draculon.
Trina, I never knew Trina Robbins.
Trina Robbins did the sketch, the original sketch for what she was going to look like.
Wow, and it was all owned by Warren.
Pretty much, yeah. He doesn't own it anymore. He sold the rights to...
I'll tell you this artist, I guess he's one of the Spanish artists you talked about.
Jose Gonzalez.
He's fantastic. He's really good.
Those are fun books, man.
I remember getting these black and white magazines from Marvel, you know, and they'd have different, you know, a lot of them were John Buscema and other artists, but this is awesome. Well, but was all the stories, did they bring her to Earth, or did they ever show Dracula?
She came to Earth, yeah. She came to Earth. They might have shown Dracula, but at a certain point, I think after the first few stories, she was on Earth.
But what was the point? I mean, did she do anything?
I'd have to reread it. I think she came to... I think it was. It could have been one of those they were running out of blood and Dracula, and I don't remember. I really don't remember.
Because I want to say this, and these look really nice, but all I see is a really scantily clad, good-looking woman in high heels running around the city, and it seemed like things are going on, and this one seems like a different artist and funny.
I don't know. Now it changes after that. Now you got a different story.
Oh, still Jose Gonzalez, though. It looks more like Jack Davis sometimes. Yeah, I just never knew. I didn't know if she was an alien. But
she's an alien.
But she was a real vampire?
She was one of those Planet of the Vampire women.
But did she ever get victims and drink blood or
anything?
Sure,
in the beginning. Yeah, oh yeah, she did, yeah. See, now that's when Warren started doing color because they needed to compete, whatever. I'm not sure if that was colored by. I think that that book, instead of having separate different stories, that whole book might be Vampirella.
Yeah, stories. It looks like Bill DeBay colored it.
Now, the cover was by some guy called Enric, who's a Spanish painter, and he's Enrique something or other. I can't think of his... But if this is the book that I remember, I seem to remember buying this book, visiting my dad who was in the hospital. He was sick. This was in the 70s. I think this might be the one. But I do remember.
Yeah, this one says.
And I got that at a hospital, believe it or not.
Yeah.
The hospital newsstand.
Yeah. This one says the whole, Jose Gonzalez drew the whole issue.
Yeah.
The cover is by San Julian?
Was it San Julian? I thought it was Enrich. Okay, San Julian, who's still around.
Yeah.
Oh, Jose, yeah, San Julian. Okay.
San Julian. I was wanting to say San Julian, but well, no, but I know that's not right.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't matter.
It looks kind of like Jones and Frazetta.
Yeah, they were. Wow. That was the, you know, that was a template for.
This is, I guess, this story here in the center is colored by Bill DeBay, but I'm guessing it was originally done for black and white. It looks good.
Sure.
It's got a kind of a muddy quality, but
it's
still
got
like
gray
it.
Tones in it, yeah.
But I still like it. It's colored well.
It's definitely the guy who drew it, Jose Gonzalez or whatever, just drew it in washes, and they said, hey, color the story. Like, the whole issue is in gray tones and washes and stuff like that. Yeah, these guys were all Spanish artists, you know, again. And, I mean, one day I'll research the story of why. I guess they were cheaper.
That's so strange, because you would think, for some reason, when I think of Spain, I think of more expensive. It's the old world, so I would think it'd be more expensive.
It's almost like, you know, what they do now with outsourcing.
Yeah.
Outsourcing. Well, you remember, if I remember correctly, again, my memory, that in the early 70s, Neil Adams and Wrightson and some of these guys wanted to start a comic book artist union.
Yeah, you mentioned
and this
that.
Was their... I don't know if this was their reaction to it, but there was something about that. And then Warren was always didn't pay great rates, and I guess he got a good deal for Spain. So he brought all these guys in. And like I said, they're really good. But if you read these stories, there's something is lost in translation. Sometimes you read these stories, and the art almost doesn't seem like it's following the story. If Archie Goodwin's writing it, he's probably making it pretty coherent, but I've read some of these recently, and just the art, the verbiage, and the drawings. I was missing something. You know what I mean?
I guess the question when you mentioned that's interesting. But do you think that were these done Marvel style, where they had a synopsis?
I think these. I don't know, but I'm thinking these guys are. I'm thinking what they did was they were given scripts. This is all my imagination. They were given scripts in English. And they were sent over there, and some guy translated them into Spanish. And I was like, here, draw here, her here, and draw her there, and this and that. And then when it got back to the writer, again, I don't remember reading this one. So.
It's kind of like that Flash Gordon movie Dino De Laurentiis did, and nobody communicated well. I'll tell you, this guy can draw. And I asked you about if you ever saw her taking victims. In the first one, it looks like she's going to get that guy's neck, and somebody comes in and screaming on, no, not Adam. And that drawing's fantastic. And then they fight, because I guess it looks like she's going to kiss him, but you can see she's going for the neck.
Yeah.
You've already killed my brother. I won't let you rob me of my son. I'll destroy you first. Wow, and he tries to put a stake through her heart. And then she disappears. Wow. Okay, so she did do so. And then more scantily clad women.
Which is what sells to guys in their teens.
Yeah. Yeah, this is nice. But the whole issue is Vampirella. So I'm guessing.
Usually there were different stories, but this one seems to be like a whole selection. Does it say something about the best Summer Giant? Best issue ever of Vampirella Classics. It's a collection.
So, they just put a bunch of short stories together and made one, which is nice.
And this is Jose Gonzalez, too. This is real nice. That's the same guy. He was a great artist, man. I got to tell you, though, I mean, I like some of his work, but some of it's like I don't like. So it gets a little cartoony, but maybe that's good and bad, you know. But
There was a couple of pages in there that I said it looked kind of like Jack Davis, and it was kind of cartoony, who I like Jack Davis, but it looked like some of the mad parodies, and it would be two pages. The artist changed, and all of a sudden it switches back to that beautifully serious, sexy-looking style.
That's great stuff.
No, I did like it when Warren would do that. Like, I had an issue of all Esteban Moroto stories.
Yeah.
It was in Creepy. And then I had another of all the guy that did Richard Corbin. I had a bunch of his stories. I like that, where you just get one, and they were just like a collection of their stuff, and that's what that one is. Quite nice.
All right, let me go through this here. Well, why don't I just pick this one on the top here?
We're good.
E-Man, why not? Charlton Comics.
E-Man was a book that as a kid when I saw it, I thought, God, this sucks. It just looked like a stupid second, third-rate character that Charlton was trying to jump in on a superhero thing. Me and my friends would make fun of it. For some odd reason, I saw issue 6 that had Frankenstein on the cover and a robot, and I thought, all right, I'll try it. So I bought it. And I never read a book. Well, Plastic Man was always tongue-in-cheek. And I read this, and it seemed like they kind of played it serious and played it tongue-in-cheek and was making fun of it. And then the second story was Raj 2000, again written by Nicola Coody and drawn by John Byrne. It was about a robot. So I was telling a couple of my friends. Yeah, I was in 8th grade at the time. I'm like, well, is this serious or is it funny? Well, it's kind of both. And then they read it. Everybody started collecting E-Man. I got 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and they canceled the series. It was fun stuff. They brought E-Man back later. I think Marty Pascal was writing it. It wasn't the same, but they were fun. Again, the first 5 issues I'd seen later, I didn't really care for. It was a quirky book. But Joe Staten drew him.
Frankenstein. Kinda,
yeah, it was an amusement park. His girlfriend is named Nova Kane, and they're at an amusement park, and there's a little girl that they save in the book, and Nova Kane is in she's in a beauty contest in a swimsuit with a friend of hers. And what the story is about was there's a guy that builds all these animatronics in the amusement park, and the amusement park starts going after people, and come to find out, I guess his little girl was taken from him and murdered, and so he was taking it out on the owner, saying all she wanted was money. Come to find out, Nova Kane's daughter was friend was his daughter. Uh-huh. Who grew up. It was wild, but it was just weird because you see some of these Donald Duck looking characters going after E-Man and Frankenstein.
Isn't that Raj 3 2000 or something like that?
He's in the book, but I think because of Raj 2000, Joe Staten was starting to draw robots like that. But it is silly.
Oh,
no,
here's Raj by Byrne and Duffy.
That was the first time Byrne did Raj in Charlton Comics.
I didn't know Nick Cuddy was the guy who scripted. Oh, this is a very nice book, man. Frankenstein.
But four of those books had Raj in them. There was 4 stories, and then one story was all E-Man all the way through. And I asked Nicola Coody, I saw him in Tampa and we were talking, and he said,
this is nice.
I said I never read one because it was so tongue in cheek, and he said, I never liked superheroes. And he said that's the only way he could write them. And he was talking about Jack Cole's Plastic Man, which were books I loved. It was fun, sometimes sort of serious, sometimes not, zany. The problem is, they brought Plastic Man back. Ramona Freyden drew them, and that's why I bought them. I'm guessing Marty Pascal maybe wrote them. I'm not positive. But the problem is, when you start writing it slapstick, it's not quite the same. If you write it as a serious story and just have fun with it, that's kind of how it has to be done, but I'm guessing it's hard to do, because I don't see that very often. No. A lot of time, the one you always like, Batlash. Yeah. Sergio Arganez kind of co-wrote it, co-created it, and he'd write the stories, and he said the same thing, that what you have to do is write a serious story and then add fun elements to it. And then when Sergio Arganez stopped doing it, he said the whole thing just turned into a bunch of pratfalls. It was just kind of slapstick funny, and he says that's the wrong thing to do. So only stuff I can think of like that was Plastic Man, E-Man, and Batlash. I don't know what other books were like that. There must have been more.
Inferior Five was a time book.
Yeah, that was fun.
And there was a few of them that they did. DC was doing a few of them. But they did the satirical books. I think I liked those better than the serious ones in a lot of ways, because they were just fun. This isn't a pull up loser, but I just found this, and this is, I just wanted to mention this because this book came with a special. I don't remember where I bought this. I think in South Florida. This book came with something special in it.
It's Mad 132 from 1970?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's not.
It came with a story by Cindy Eiler. Okay?
Wow.
I picked this up like a few months ago, And I'm looking through, and I was like, wait a minute, here's some, like, paper from the 70s.
Yeah, he's got a rolled five-ring binder notebook paper, and it's all yellowed.
Cindy, it looks like Eiler, E-I-L-E-R, and it's a Christmas story.
Where'd you get this? It was in the Mad Magazine?
The girl put it in the Mad Magazine. And I guess it just, I don't know what happened with it, but it's been there for I don't know how long. But when I bought the book, I bought it years ago. I probably never opened it. And I was like looking through my books and I go, oh, there's a man. Oh, I wanted to read some Dave Berg. And then this is in here.
Did you read it?
Yeah, I read it. It was good. I don't know if this was a high school thing or if what it was, but it's funny. Sometimes you find special things.
Yeah, I never thought.
In these books, it's a little four-page story, so Cindy Eiler, if you're listening to this podcast, I have a story here, and if you want it back, I'll send it to you, your Christmas story. It's good.
But you enjoyed it.
Wow. Yeah, it's good, yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I forgot about it, and when I saw
it's pretty wild.
Yeah, I've seen receipts in books.
Yeah.
I've seen, like, people's names, like, property of Ben.
Yeah.
And it's a Christmas issue, so you were at Christmas. I've never seen an entire, somebody write a four-page story in it. It looks like it's a high school thing or something. I don't know.
So. Yeah, so I remember a long time ago, one of the books you had, you said, I don't know who this guy is, but somebody's name was written on the cover of one of the old books you bought. I've never, that story's in good shape, too.
It's in good shape.
But you enjoyed it. That's funny. Yeah, it is a Christmas.
It was
well written.
It was fine. It was good. It was good. I was just like, okay. And then I just was going through the Pulpalooza books, and I go, I wonder if that, oh, shit, a story is still in there. That's the craziest one, you know. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that because,
you said they want Pulpalooza, so let me pull one of yours.
Right. Let me go through this pile here.
Al's really organized. I got one pile. He's got bags with different.
I just pulled a whole bag out. Whatever.
I'll just pull this one.
It's a Marvel one.
Masters of Terror. Yeah, you're right. Marvel preview.
I think that's got a lot of Gene Colan art in it.
It's a dollar for a large magazine from Curtis. So it's from 78. I didn't know these magazines went that long.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, fall 1978.
Sure they did.
John Buscema did the
front piece.
Yeah, an old mob flapper type thing.
Fantastic artist.
Yeah, it is. It looks more like the Filipino artist, how he finished it. That's why you always liked his inking.
I like the rougher inking.
Yeah, he had a rough, which is strange.
Is that Gene Colan?
This one looks like it. I don't see credits.
It's probably like Gene Colan inked by DeZuniga.
Yeah, it looks
looking
like
at it upside down.
Yeah, because it's got Gene Colan's angles and different
shadings
perspective. Yeah. He nobody drew like Gene Colan.
I think that whole book might be by him. Is that Morbius, the Living Vampire, in there?
Well, this is some kind of werewolf.
Oh, okay. I didn't know what that was. That's a woman. That's a woman.
That isn't. Yeah, but it's a. Now that looks like his Dracula, but I don't think it is.
No, that's just a different story. Now that looks like it's Colan.
Gene Colan, Tom Palmer.
Tom Palmer doing washes.
Yeah,
you know?
God, those are nice. Is Tom Palmer your favorite Gene Colan
inker? Yeah, definitely.
Tom Palmer
looks like Kirby and Sinnott to me.
Yeah, Tom Palmer had a tightness, but he also seemed like he could work with loose people. Oh, here's Gene Colan and Tony DiNizuniga.
Okay.
Steve Gerber was the writer.
Yeah, that's Lilith, I think, isn't it? The vampire?
Yeah, what was she? I never read stories, I just see her.
Dracula's daughter?
Oh, okay.
I think she was Dracula's daughter.
I just see her in advertisements, some Marvel calendars and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're trying to do a Vampirella.
Oh.
So they got her. I'm pretty sure she was Dracula's daughter.
Her name was Lilith.
Yeah. She's like a Vampirella type.
I never thought of that. It makes sense, though. But Vampirella came out in the 60s. Oh, wow. Robin Hood by Howard Chaykin.
That was a...
Portfolio.
Portfolio, yeah.
Pacific Comics.
Well, and Rev Rock came out in 69 or 70, so it was pretty late in the game, but...
Vampirella?
Yeah. That was a good one, too. Blackhawk. I think I got one of those in there, too.
I had that one, yeah.
And the paperback I have, too.
I got this one. It was in the grocery store. I just picked it up, and I thought, wow, that looks neat. It was Gil Kane. That's one of my favorite pieces. And I didn't realize it was a paperback till you showed it to me. Strong word. I know this is... I didn't see any credit
for the first one. Is it on the side? Is it like... See if it's on the front, like on the...
I'm going to pass it to you.
Yeah, let me see if it's the center.
The other one's right on the bottom, and it was prominent. But I know that's Gene Colan, but I don't see the inker.
Yeah, right here it says, by Richard Marshall, Gene Colan, Tony DeZuniga.
Oh, okay.
Tom Palmer, and then, yeah, DeZuniga did two stories, and Tom Palmer did the voices, the middle story, and that is John Buscema. It almost seems like this doesn't even belong to this book. It's like a gangster. Maybe he's killing a vampire. I don't know.
Man, John Buscema, he did a lot of work. I mean, a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. He would crank it out beautifully.
Yeah, because he did a lot of the mainstream, you know, four-color books, but then when the magazines came out, I remember he did a lot of stories.
This is a rougher style for him, though, but it's almost like he's looking, doing like a trying to do like a Gibson, Charles Dana Gibson style or whatever.
So. It looks nice, though.
Yeah, yeah. And the cover's by Tom Palmer. Yeah, cover's by Tom Palmer.
Is Tom Palmer still alive?
Yeah, he is. Did it say anything here? You can shoot him right seven. Yeah, there it is right there. Palmer. Yep.
Well, Tom
I can
Palmer.
Tell by these figures more so than the one.
I remember he did covers, like he did the cover to that a wraparound cover of that Beatles book.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, did he ever draw comics?
Yeah, occasionally. Not short stories.
I knew him as an inker, and then I remember his covers, but
he was just probably but faster as an inker.
Makes sense.
Oh, here's a good one.
That's from Beyond the Unknown, which
yeah,
I guess was a reprint. It was a reprint book from there's that's the ad. For Vampirella
Models. Ad from yeah, they got him in trouble. Yeah, these are classic reprints from the 50s or the early 60s.
Yeah, I guess it was some Strange Tales and maybe other ones.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of my favorite books. It was DC's From Beyond the Unknown. And it was always Carmine Infantino, Gil Kane, Murphy Anderson drawing stories. And it was always science fiction. This is one of my favorite ones. It was The Dawn World of Menace. And basically, there's these cavemen. And there was some kind of a portal that opened up. And pterodactyls came through. And somehow, the cavemen jumped into it, fought the pterodactyls, and they ended up in the Ice Age. And they're all freezing. The cavemen get up, see a caribou. They kill it. They eat it. And they share it with the pterodactyls. Next thing you know, they're riding the pterodactyls like horses. And they go through the portal again, and they come to our modern world, I guess in the 50s or 60s. And wherever they go, everything disintegrates. Farm equipment disintegrates. The people's clothes disintegrates. They're sending the military after them. And the planes get too close to disintegrates. And their weapons are... has some kind of radiation near the spears and their bows. I don't know. And the problem is they can't eat. Every time they get close to any kind of plant, the plant disintegrates. And finally, this one guy shows up and tricks them and takes them away. Some of these stories really freak me out. I think this is Tommy Tomorrow. But Earth for Sale. I just think these are greatness. It's kind of like a Twilight Zone type thing.
Sure.
But, yeah, it's some of my favorites. Some of these space creatures I just found haunting. You know, Sid Green drew that.
Yeah, Otto Binder, Sid Green, and Joe Gale. Like, Joe Gale is still alive. Still drawing Mary... He's either drawing Mary Worth or Apartment 3G.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Joe Gillis.
No, I always remember him as an inker all the time, but he's drawing now.
He's got to be like in his late 80s, early 90s. He must have been very young when he did that, but yeah.
The story we're talking about is the sign language of space, and it's got these aliens that have these, they're kind of blue turquoise, and they don't have mouths, and as a kid reading those, they always creep me out because they'd come and communicate with people sign language, and they just look haunting. But when I saw these books, it was one of my favorite books, and I didn't realize it was all just old reprint stories. The thing was, these
Kubert cover.
Yeah, Joe Kubert did a lot of the covers for it, not all of them. But I think Michael Kaluta did one of the covers.
Sure did.
And I absolutely loved them. The thing is, you know, we always talk about anthology books. I liked anthology books, but sometimes the anthology books just had a lot of artists I didn't care for. But these, I liked all the artists.
Cy Berry, Carmen Infantino, Sid Green, Joe Gala. Yeah, all these guys are great, man. Who did this one? Is this... Carmen Infantino and Bernard. Infantino did a lot of these. I keep thinking Cy Berry looks to me like the guy who did Batlash. I can't think of his name right now.
Nick Carty?
He reminds me in this a little bit of Nick Carty, but not.
Cy Berry is a name I've seen, but I couldn't tell you anything about him.
He did a lot of newspaper strips like The Phantom and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's how I know him, from The Phantom.
Yeah, there was Cy Berry and there was another Dan Barry.
Yeah.
Dan Barry did like comic books, but then he went and did like Flash Gordon's and stuff like that. Apparently Dan Barry was like a tough guy to get along with, but Cy Berry, I don't know much about
him. Were they related? Do you know?
No.
I remember the story now. Cy Berry, I've seen his name. It does look kind of like Nick Carty.
A little bit.
But, yeah, Dan Barry, he did a Vigilante, too, for DC, or whoever did the old ones.
Yeah.
I honestly never really cared for his style that much. He was a good artist, but it just wasn't one that I adhered to. And Neil Adams was talking one time, telling him, he says he was complaining to the comics industry, newspaper comics, you guys don't know what you're doing. He says, you never should have got Dan Barry to replace Alex Raymond. You should have got Al Williamson. But they wouldn't go to Al Williamson because he was a comic book guy. And they
I didn't know that.
Neil Adams said that on Fat Man on Batman. But he said Al Williamson wants to do it. He can do it. He should have done it. And he says, but you wouldn't get him because he's a comic guy. And he says he was the reason that they got Joe Kubert to do that Green Beret comic strip.
Neil Adams was?
Neil Adams was the one that told him, try Joe Kubert. And Joe Kubert talked to DC, says, I want to try this. So they gave him a hiatus, and he went and did a... What was the name of that Green Beret strip?
Tales of the Green Beret.
Tales of the Green Beret.
It's funny, because even though they wouldn't give Al Williamson Flash Gordon, Al Williamson in the 50s and 60s ghosted and later worked on the other Raymond, the spy one.
Secret Agent X-9
or one. I don't know if Secret Agent X-9 became Corrigan or whatever, but he did those, so...
Was that before Flash Gordon or after?
I don't know. After, maybe?
See, I never knew. And like Congo Bill, what was it?
I have a big old volume of Corrigan there somewhere, but...
See, I never knew when any of these books were being done.
I think the Flash Gordon strip, when Raymond left... Austin Briggs took over, and then I think when he, whatever happened with him, I don't know if he died or he just left, and then instead of getting Al Williamson, they got Dan Barry, but that was in the early 50s. I don't know, maybe Neil Adams is talking about later on when they redid it or something, I don't know. Al Williamson did do the comic book.
Yeah.
The King Features comic book. He did a few issues of Flash Gordon. They were perfect.
Yeah, they were nice. I liked him.
I just reprinted one. I just posted one on Destination Mind. They're perfect. He is the replacement for Alex Raymond. He's like the disciple of Alex Raymond. But, hey, whatever, man. I don't know. I don't know what the deal was.
Well, he had an audience. People liked him.
Yeah, so are we done or you want to do more?
Wow, we've been talking a long time.
Okay.
Let's do one more.
All right, here you grab one more. The grand finale. There you go.
Howard the Duck.
There's another Marvel book from the 80s.
I didn't realize that.
I think that's more Gene Colan.
I didn't realize they had a Howard the Duck magazine.
Sure they did.
Number 2, $1.25. And it is from 1979.
Mike Golden did some of those.
The cover was Val Merrick, a painted cover.
Oh, that's nice.
Let's see here. First script is Bill Mantlow, art by Gene Colan and Klaus Janson.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it looks nice, too.
Yeah, Klaus Janson did a nice job on Gene Colan.
Yeah, and it's washed.
Sure.
Gray washes. Wait, yeah, I was to say, he didn't cover up Gene Colan's look.
No.
That's hard to do for some people. Savage Sword with John Buscema.
Is that Dave Simmons and Gene Colan?
Yeah, how did you know that? Do you remember this from memory or just
recognize?
I remember
from memory, I see the line work changing. Even upside down, I see the line work changing. I go, that looks like Dave Simmons.
This second story is, again, Bill Mantlow, drawn by Gene Colan, Inc. by Dave Simmons, as Al mentioned, but same penciler, but completely different look. Wow. And the alarm clock has tentacles and clawed feet. And there, Beverly and Howard the Duck are in bed. And I guess that's a bizarre story.
As all Howard the Duck stories are.
I had this.
You got that call line.
The reason I bought this is in the back it had a portfolio by John and Marie Severin of Cole. And I bought it I think it had 5 or 6 drawings in it, that's why I bought it. I can't remember who did the front. Oh, it says, stories and art by Roy Thomas, Sal Buscema, Tony DeZuniga, John and Marie Severin, and other bullpen greats. Hmm. Enough said. But I bought it for the John and Marie Severin drawings. Man, these are not, I didn't.
You never got those, huh?
No, I never bought any. I bought them. When Howard the Duck, I picked up the first issue. I had Spider-Man on the cover. I looked through it.
That was a hard-to-find book.
It wasn't in Oklahoma at the time. Every store I went to, I'd pick it up, and it was everywhere.
Lucky you, man. It was hard
to find.
Well,
I never bought it. Is this Red Sonja? And I never bought it, but then he got so popular, he was in everything. Every Marvel ad, everything. He had his own newspaper strip. It was just the biggest thing in the world. And then Disney tried to sue him, and they had to change his appearance slightly. But he was huge. I remember at one point in 1978 or 79, the first issue, which I guess is originally 25 cents or 35 cents, it was $10. And this woman in a comic store in Wichita Falls, Texas, was talking about there's some guy that, I guess, bought a whole stack of them and sandbagged them. Mm-hmm. And when it was up to $10, he was trying his hardest to sell them. And so the word got out, nobody would touch him. He was getting upset. But I remember I bought a couple of issues, one just to see what was going on. And it was an odd issue. Val Merrick drew it. And it was... basically, they were all frames. The page was a frame he drew, and the front part, it was all typewritten. Like, I don't know, synopsis or scripts. But it was in a four-color comic. What is this about? And I think I bought one other book, and it just never appealed to me. But it appealed to everybody else. It was huge. He had a magazine, he had this and that.
Yeah.
And then Steve Gerber.
It was just a crazy comic book.
Yeah.
See, the Steve Gerber stories are really bizarre.
This is after, I guess, Steve Gerber left.
Yeah, the ones where Kiss shows up and,
I didn't know Kiss was in those.
Oh, yeah, Kiss was in 2 issues of your comic book, the 4-color, and that's all. Those are like, that's like, craziness. Yep, sure.
I didn't, who was it, I didn't know that Howard the Duck appeared in, what was it, Defenders?
Yeah, probably.
It was in that Marvel Comics The Untold story. They said that every once in a while, in the I guess Doctor Strange's mansion. You'd open a door and you see the Man Thing, or you see Howard the Duck walk through the hallways. I didn't know that was going on, but it was from Steve Gerber.
You know that in Defenders, Blue Oyster Cult showed up in.
No, I never read those.
I forgot what issue there were. Blue Oyster Cult were.
Well, wow, I didn't know Howard the Duck had his own magazine.
Yeah, a few issues. Yeah, Mike, like I said, Golden drew some of them, and I think really, it amazes me how like, how great some of these artists are.
Yeah.
All the stuff that they drew in these. I mean, the writers would come up with these cockamamie, like in this panel do this, and these guys are just boom. Unbelievable. Unbelievable artists. Greater than you ever thought they were. Even if you don't say, well, this isn't great art, try drawing it, man.
It's one thing.
It's unbelievable.
Now, I do remember at times where I would pick these up, and, of course, I didn't care for Gene Cole at the time. It's changed now. I do like him quite well. But I just remember seeing a lot of John Buscema, a lot of Gene Colan books, and after a while, it just doesn't seem special. I look back on it now, and I think, God, this is second to none work.
At the time, there was so much of it. You were like, you wanted something different or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to me, it's like whatever, problem Jim Shooter had with Gene Cole. I mean, give me a friggin' break, dude. I mean, but we've talked about it before. I can understand where he was coming from. But the reality is that, like, Jim, try drawing this crap that these writers throw at you, and maybe you'll see it from a different way, but, anyway.
Well, that's the thing with Gil Kane. Stan Lee didn't like Gil Kane. He liked Gil Kane, but he didn't like his artwork and didn't want him for Marvel. But then when Roy Thomas is running the ship, he used Gil Kane for everything because he felt differently.
Sure.
And I guess that sometimes with certain art directors, they have a certain taste, and that's what they want.
That's it, yeah. Well, somebody was telling me, or I read somewhere, where Tusco was drawing a story by somebody or another, and basically he said to the writer, you know what, I don't feel like drawing that, and he just didn't do it, and drew something else. The writer just said, okay, Mr. Tusco, all right.
So he drew a different story?
Not a panel or two, or a section or whatever. He just said, no, I don't feel like drawing this. He just didn't draw. I don't remember. I just read it recently. I can't remember where it was. I'm only gonna be able to figure. But when I come across it again, I will bring it to your attention in the blah. Yeah, it was like Tusco was like, I don't feel like drawing that. Whatever the panel was or the series was, I was like, just change it. He was like, okay. Yeah, I know. Isn't that amazing? I guess because he's George Tusco. If you're Jack. Whatever, you can't do it. But George Tusco said, I don't feel like drawing this. Whatever it was. I'll have to find it.
See, that
boggles your mind.
Well,
when
I say that, I want to take an objective thing, thinking, well, maybe if the story still makes sense. I've read stuff where sometimes the artist would talk to the writer or vice versa. And I said, well, I have trouble doing this. Can I make this? Yeah, go ahead, But I don't know, I just don't feel like drawing it. I guess the story still reads okay.
Sure.
But I don't know if this is anything, but like with, I do think Gene Colan was really done wrong by Jim Shooter.
Yeah, he was.
I can just imagine, like, say what George Tusco did. If Gene Colan pulled any of that, this guy's a hack. I'm tired of him. Get him out of here. You know what I mean? Sometimes.
Well, if Gene Colan,
if
George Tusco pulled that on Jim Shooter back then, he probably would have been like booted out. But it was in an interview. Oh God, it was something I was reading, one of those Amazing Heroes or Comics interview.
Yeah,
it just cracked me up, and I was like, no, really? You got away with that, huh? Okay, whatever. it was either like a building or a car or something like that. And it's like, I just do this or something along those lines, and so he just redrew it or redid it, and the guy goes, here you go.
Well, Chris Claremont was talking one time, he wasn't bagging anybody else. What he was saying was how much he really loved to work with Alan Davis, and he says that there was never any time him and Alan Davis did a story and he wrote in the script and Alan Davis says, I can't draw this. And when I say that, they would hate working with me because I'm limited. I can draw some things, but other things, well, dude, I don't know if I'd feel comfortable doing that. And, some people have trouble drawing animals or kids or, certain things, cars. And but he, you know, Chris Claremont was just delighted that no matter what he drew, he never, Alan Davis never said, look, I can't draw this. Alan Davis would draw it or figure out how to draw it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe George
yeah, getting old maybe, I don't know. Yeah. I wish I could find it. It was something I was reading the other day.
Well, you'll think about it
yeah,
later.
Yeah, I'll think about
we'll go over it again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's like when Kirby was getting scripts from, you know, Stan Lee, it was basically like, let's have Magneto, let's have yeah, bless you. Let's have so-and-so, you know, the Watcher show up, and then Galactus and the Fantastic Four fights the Black Panther. Go to it. And Jack would just sit there in a week or two and draw the damn thing and give it to him. So that, in some ways, is the best way to work. But some guys prefer to be told exactly what you're drawing every panel.
Some people can do that. Like, they always bring up that, you know, he was working with really seasoned people. Steve Ditko, Jack Kirby, they'd worked a long time, and they could do that. I would hate that. Maybe if I was really experienced and been doing it, but right now, if I work with somebody, I say, okay, look, draw this. Well, what do I do? You know, I need a little bit of help and direction.
So if somebody wrote you a script, would you prefer it? If they wrote a script and then they gave you, alongside the script, like a page of stick figures?
Right now, yeah, I would like that. Would help. Now,
I've worked that way before. It's helpful.
Yeah, because you did some comics. No.
How?
What was your favorite?
The Delta Wave book that I did. The writer was very specific, and he actually did like rough drawings of the panel, and I would just go out and I would look for. Try to draw it as close as possible, but basically he was telling me exactly how the page should be laid out. This panel should be this, and he would give me like an idea, and I would try to get as close to it as possible, or you know, or whatever. And then and some other guys would just give you a panel description, and you know, you go and do whatever you can. But it varies. And then I have a script somewhere in the garage where, like, Bill Matlow just writes a one-page synopsis and just says, Pat Broderick, this is what we're going to do, blah, 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 blah. You know, give me 20 pages, and then I'll figure it out.
Yeah, see, like, I know different people work different ways. Alan Moore, he writes scripts that are just he describes every single thing in the panel. And, he doesn't expect the artist to follow it, per se, but he gives you as much information as you get. Now, J.H. Williams, when he's doing Promethea, he was working so hard trying to stay on top of that book that he was having to get his wife to run through it and then highlight the parts he would need. And it was on the Sidebar podcast when we talked about it. And they said, was Alan Moore ever upset? He goes, no, I never heard that. He says, but there were later where In the scripts you send, and Alan Moore would address it to J.H. Williams' wife and says, I think this part you might want to bring up to him because it's kind of important. Well, he understood.
Yeah.
But some artists appreciate all the information. Alan Moore said he used to lay out the book. You know, I mean, he would draw the stick figures, like you said, and then he stopped because he realized the artists weren't, you know, they didn't bother. It was just like a pain to them, more information. Mike Barron, well, I was reading him one time, he said, he wrote up a script, but he also broke it down in, like, the stick figure panels. And, well, that makes sense. But then Steve Rude was saying that when he gets those, he doesn't even look at them. He just throws them away. Well, again, it was a different working thing. If you and I were doing a comic...
I don't mind somebody giving me stick figures.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
I don't mind.
I wouldn't like it if they wanted you to follow... I'd try to follow, just like you said, exactly as close as they could, but there may be times I think, well, it'd probably work a little better, feel a little better, more fun if I did it this way. As long as the story still reads and makes sense. And the ones I read, it sounded like Alan Moore and these guys, they didn't mind the artist changing them up. They were just trying to help them. Well, to me, it would help to break down the story to figure out what you were doing.
That's exactly right. I mean, it, you know, it's...
Well, and that's what Sal Buscema did for Marvel a lot of times, is they would have him break down the story and another artist to go in and draw it, because he was really good at that.
I used to have them. I don't know where they are. I used to have, like, the layouts of Sal Buscema, and they were basically, like, as simple breakdowns as you could. Just no shading, just, like, the figure, not a little bit of definition, and then Klaus Janser would go over it and boom, you know, give it all... do exactly what he did on that Gene Colan, all the shadows, all the muscles,
right,
and all that. So there was But then again, I'm sure Sal Buscema was being told to do this over a weekend.
Oh, exactly. But that's what I mean. I remember he was in, what was it, Comic Geek Speak, I think was the podcast, and he said that he was drawing comics, and Marvel found out he was really good at, you know, laying the books out and breaking it down, and he became their go-to guy. And it's exactly what he said, I need this thing overnight, or this artist is doing it, but, you know, to me, whenever I tried to do a comic strip, the hardest thing for me to do was to lay the story out, and you know, where it reads and makes sense. It was a lot of planning, a lot of this, and then when you draw it, it seemed like the drawings just kind of flashed a lot quicker.
Yeah.
But for some reason, when I was trying to do all of it, I'd start getting overwhelmed, like, oh, God, this is, you know, and when I read about these writers that would write your story and it kind of break it down for you a little bit, I mean, not that you have to follow it verbatim, but that's a huge weight off. But I guess those other guys are just really good at doing that. You know, they look at it as an insult. They want to follow it the way they want it. So, I mean, it's not
whatever
really
works.
Any one way. Yeah.
Whatever works, you know, I mean, I don't know how Kirby worked before Marvel. I really don't.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he was Joe Simon and him. You know, I don't know. But anyway, as long as it looks good and it reads good and it sells, it's fine.
It's fine. We talked about a lot of stuff today, man.
Yes, we did. Yes, all we
right.
did.
Anyway,
it's been a very interesting show.
Yeah, we covered the gauntlet on this.
Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate you listening. Thank you very much. If you do listen to the show and like it, please feel free to tell somebody else about it. And if you could listen to us on iTunes, please leave us a review or even write a review, a rating, and write us a review. It would really help. We're up to 11.
Oh, good. Yeah. We got 11 reviews?
Yeah.
Are they all good?
Yeah, yeah. Surprisingly.
Hey, does Roddy Frey still write to our show? Did you ever hear from him?
No, I haven't in a while. Sometimes he'll come on like it, but...
Mao was asking about it, I think he's still, like, around. You know, I think he still, like, listens to
yeah,
the show.
But I'm sure he got busy with something.
He's yeah, well, just, Roddy, hey, you know. Shout out.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you just get busy and don't go on, and
yeah,
you know, he'll pop up
yeah,
later.
Understand.
But, yeah, he's still involved.
All right.
Anyway, anything else you want to say?
No, man.
All right.
All talked out.
We're all talked. Yeah, how many podcasts have you done today?
I'm emotionally drained.
All right, listen, thanks for everything. We'll see you next time. And in the meantime,
read
more comments.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas' webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!